let's not come to order. Yeah, I don't know what happened. I thought we'd be attracting record crowds again for healthcare homes and county-based people are here. I bet you won't even get applause either later. if the department wants to come down, I'm willing to gamble we're not going to get to the Department of Health, but I don't know that. So maybe they'll hang around or leave. But if they want to, but we're going to have some testimony from some people who succeeded with healthcare homes as well. So we'll just see how the time goes. If everybody's not chatty, then we'll get through more material. And anyway, Dr. Schiff, and you can. So we are. We haven't got a quorum yet, do we? I do want to get started, however, and so I think that we'll just start with your testimony, and then we'll proceed to that. You've got 40 minutes or so, I think, for the whole pack, and you know that, right?
Yep.
Okay. Well, welcome to the committee, you can hop to it. Thanks.
Thanks.
Is there time for questions in your presentation too, or is it tons of material?
Okay. Mr. Chair, we have asked our presenters to be succinct, but we'll work on that.
Well, that goes without saying. Okay. Thanks. So, why don't you proceed and introduce yourself or whoever.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are actually a few of us presenting. Assistant Commissioner Lights, I suspect, will be here shortly. I wanted to first tell you that we had an opportunity because Dr. Grundy, who is the Director of Healthcare Technology and Strategic Initiatives for IBM Global Wellbeing Services and Health Benefits, is in town, and I had the pleasure of talking to him yesterday and said, what if you change your flight and stick around, because I think your message about what's happening nationally and about the importance of this is would be good for this committee to hear. And so Dr. Grundy agreed to stay, and we're very happy to have him. He is also the president of the Patient-Centered Primary Care Collaborative, which is a coalition of employers that is really dedicated towards advancing the new primary care model, which in turn is essential to maintaining, reforming healthcare and maintaining U.S. competitiveness. The other thing I'll say about Dr. Grundy very briefly is that he's not new to Minnesota or our weather. He spent 5 years down in Rochester. So, Dr. Grundy.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And members, it's a real pleasure to be here. This is kind of my second.
Oh, you have to say your name for the.
My name is Dr. Paul Grundy.
Thank you.
And again, I'm IBM's Global Director of Healthcare Transformation. I come at this really from the perspective of a large corporate buyer of care. IBM spends about $1.3 billion for the healthcare that we buy. And we have about 628,000 reasons to care about this from the standpoint of our lives and our members. And we have a significant chunk of those folks right here in Minnesota. We are a large presence here. This is a state we've been in for a long time. And to start off with, it's a huge notice to us that our overall price point of healthcare in Minnesota is about 2 percentage points lower than the national cost is for our employees. We pay attention to those kinds of details, and it should be to folks here in this room a real economic concern and not just a health concern that you would want to attract and retain your employees because you have better. We literally move jobs to places where we get better health care. It's that important to us now as a large employer. It's no longer a benefits issue. It's a cost and survival issue for us as large employers. So we are huge supporters of a concept of care that you call here the patient-centered healthcare home, the patient-centered medical home. We now are lucky enough to have about 32,000 of our lives enrolled in a medical home, our largest concentration being in Vermont and Minnesota being our second largest concentration. And when we look at the data, and by the way, IBM does data, right? When we look at the data, what we see is that when somebody is lucky enough to have a medical home as their source of primary care and their integrator into specialty care, it costs us on average 10.6% less significant. We see about a 32% decrease in hospitalization for ambulatory sensitive conditions. We see about a 36% decrease in emergency room utilization. And the reason for that, of course, is clear in the law that you passed, and you were one of the first states to really pass a law around a medical home concept of care. And it's moving from episodic to integrated care. It's moving from uncoordinated to coordinated. It's moving from inaccessible to accessible level of care. It's a model in which my employees tell me they want convenience, they want access, they want a real healing relationship, they want a meaningful relationship, and this begins to provide that. And the other thing that's misunderstood sometimes when people talk about the medical home is that it's a return to Marcus Welby, right? I mean, I think to some degree it's a return to Marcus Welby in terms of an ability to relate as a human being. But Marcus Welby never had the tools to do population management. So this is really talking about understanding not only the patients that walk into your office, but a population that you're responsible for. That's what I want to buy as a buyer of care. I'm going to move my jobs to places that has a concept of a physician who knows who's in their population.
Dr. Gurney, you finally attracted a quorum, so I want to call the meeting to order officially. You can continue. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
They heard you were here, and they're all racing in.
So the key core concept of this that's different than the concept of the HMO a few years ago is we never had the tools, we never had the technology, and we never had the concept of the teaming, right? So my patients, they really want integration of alternative care. They would like to be able to see a nurse practitioner. They would like to be able to see their chiropractor. They would like to be able to see physical therapists and have that integrated in a meaningful way at a place that's accountable. So if one talks about various programs like mental health, which is a vertical solution, or immunization, where do you integrate? Where do you have command and control? Where do you hold accountability, right? So systems at work have come to realize that that has to be built on a robust base of prevention and primary care. And the medical home is that vertical integrator, that healing relationship in which accountability occurs. So when I look at a medical home population that we're managing and I look at a specific area, I can look at the 900 docs who are delivering care, and I have a much clearer, much more transparent view of the value of the care that they're delivering, the cost of their care that they're delivering, and the outcomes. And I want to have the dials put in place to be able to pay for that and to stop paying only fee for service, right? So I go beat up on a hospital system because they're too expensive, and I say I don't want to spend this much money, and I beat them up, and they drop the price, and I come back a year later, and they're actually costing me more. Why? Even though the unit price has gone down, they've actually just delivered more services, right? Because I only have that one dial. So in a medical home, you have an alternative mechanism of paying. So we're seeing in Minnesota, for example, you're one of the eight medical home states here that's been recognized by CMS, and they're going to add a dial in there to begin to pay a certain amount per member per month for delivering care that's coordinated, right? In Grand Junction, Colorado, that dial is in place to prevent overutilization, so the primary care docs will stop referring to a physician who is charging more than a reasonable price because it's in their economic interest, because that dial is put in there. So the medical home is so important because it's that horizontal platform upon which you can have a healing relationship, and you have an absolutely clear, at the healing relationship, at the coalface level, understanding of accountability, right? That's what I want to buy. I want to buy a meaningful healing relationship. I want to buy that with access and with accountability. Now, the other thing that really has changed in these medical homes is that I have seen a 28% decrease in the number of face-to-face visits. Why? because we're paying for email encounters. We're paying for portal solutions. Patients love that. It's really efficient. It's the kind of care that they want to have, right? We've seen a marked increase in the number of encounters, but a marked decrease in the number of face-to-face encounters because they can access and ask about their lab results online. You know, and again, I would encourage the state of Minnesota to stay the course that you started on. Stick with the concept of you really have to pay for process to build medical home, to build out that solution, because at the end of the road, what we've seen in our employees and what we've seen in this report that I'll leave you that we left with the House, the Senate, and the White House last time is a marked decrease in cost. It begins to bend the curve. And in Vermont, which you're building here, you've actually begun to take sick care, right? How you deliver sick care and integrate it at the community level in these medical homes with coordination of care around health care, around health, right? So it's just an important journey, and that begins to give you your horizontal, stable platform. And with that, I'll thank you very much, and hopefully there's time for some questions.
Wait, you're sticking around? Okay, good. Okay. Dr. Schiff, maybe we'll go through your presentation with the questions at the end unless someone just has a real burning question that they can't wait.
I'm going to, Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask my colleagues from the department to come up, Assistant Commissioner Lights and Ross Owen and Marie Mays-Warres from Health.
Mr. Chair, I'll only take
welcome to the committee.
A moment. Scott Lights from the Department of Human Services, Assistant Commissioner. I'll move briefly so Marie can take my chair, but I simply want to say a couple words before Dr. Schiff and Ross give you the much more detailed background on ACOs and healthcare homes, and that is that I think DHS, as we're moving forward, what we're going to be very, very interested in moving forward, especially at times like these when we're struggling from a budgetary perspective, is making sure that we're doing our part to advance the notion of care delivery redesign and payment redesign. You're going to hear a lot this year about health reform, about insurance exchanges, and those are important things that we're going to be implementing from the federal bill. But we know that in order for premiums and costs to be affordable for people as they come in through the exchanges, we're going to also have to do our work around ensuring that we reform how we deliver care in a way that's going to be sustainable, and how we pay providers in a way that's going to encourage them and reward them for doing a lot of the things that were just talked about. So those lower cost, higher quality providers, who right now in the system, we've made some advances through the 2008 reforms in rewarding them for the work that they're doing. A lot more needs to be done to ensure that the system is actually much more sane underneath them. So I think what you're going to hear from Dr. Schiff and from Ross and Marie is a really great advances that we've already made. We know we need to do more, and I think we're very well prepared to do that. So I simply wanted to introduce that, Mr. Chair, before the presentation.
Well, thanks, and I agree that tight budget creates innovative minds. So we're here to innovate, and welcome to the committee. Who's ever next then?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Jeff Schiff, the Medical Director at the Department of Human Services, and it's a pleasure to come to you and actually tell you about the work that we've been undertaking for about the last 3 years. And it's really the foresight of this legislature that actually helped us move this along from 2006 when we had a grant fund for our Medical Home Learning Collaborative to the 2008 legislation in 2010 where we actually have an authorized gain risk-sharing demonstration available. This legislature has been out in front of other legislatures around thinking about this. At the federal level, there's a lot of legislation both and program both involved in the Affordable Care Act and some stuff that and some parts that are aside from that. And I'm going to just let you know that here's the list, and we'd really welcome any questions about it. I want to spend a little time now, though, talking about why this is so important and what we're really trying to achieve here in Minnesota and around the country. And I want to read this quote from a person who is one of the medical chief of staff at Regions just down the street. That a power imbalance exists between doctors and patients has been readily acknowledged. However, the effect of this asymmetry can be mitigated through the establishment of trust between doctor and patient. And I bring this up because we're really in the process of trying to change the way the delivery system works in a very fundamental way. But we can never lose sight of the fact that we all, as patients, because we're all patients sometime, rely on the establishment of trust between a provider and their patients. There is in the healthcare system, and there always will be, asymmetric knowledge, where the provider will always know about the choices and the risks and benefits much more than any patient will. And we have to support the role of the provider as agent and advocate for their patients. It's only after the providers can be our agents and advocates can we ask them to be stewards of resources. And our challenge in the state and in the country as we work on policy is to create the right market so that the healthcare providers who are agents and advocates can be our agents to purchase care best in the rest of the healthcare market with hospitals or specialty providers, so that we actually have somebody who knows how the market works. That market is also driven on comparative data and ongoing feedback of data to the providers. Very briefly, I'll tell you that there's a large literature on the importance of primary care. This is one of this is more of historic interest to me, but it's just a slide that talks about the importance of primary care in not just costs, but also in significant health outcomes in different countries. Dr. Grundy referred to his report, and the link is here on the bottom, but this is the report that is brand new that shows that there is significant patient-centered medical home initiatives have produced net savings in total health care expenditures for patients served by these initiatives. So I want to just, for the members who are new to this whole topic, and I apologize for those who aren't, I want to just say that what we're really about here is changing the orientation of the primary care delivery system to one that is continuous, comprehensive, coordinated, and provides first contact care. We also want the system to coordinate care at the primary care level. We want to have a partnership with patient and families that doesn't always exist. We want to link to community resources, have a continuous improvement process, and improve systems to track and monitor progress. This is the synonym slide, because if you're new, you'll also know that we call it Healthcare Home in Minnesota to emphasize health. It's also known around the country as patient-centered medical home, and federally in the Affordable Care Act, there are places where it's called advanced primary care and health home. So they're all the same. Minnesota's healthcare home program really is broken up into five major sections, and Ms. Mays-Vores and Mr. Owen will speak to these. The first is designation criteria, and the second is certification. Next is learning collaborative. The payment methodology is after that, and then outcomes and reporting of results. So I'm honored to turn this over to my colleagues from Department of Health and Human Services. I can run them if you want me.
Welcome to the committee.
Hi, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Marie Mays-Vores, and I am the director of the Healthcare Home Program. I work for the Department of Health. We're partners in the implementation of the Healthcare Home. And the Department of Health coordinates the certification, the outcomes measurement, the learning collaborative, and the general capacity building part of the implementation. I'd like to speak first just a little bit about the certification program. The certification standards were developed by our community based both on what our community believes is transformative and also achievable. The healthcare home rule was adopted and published in January of last year. And as you all know, certification is voluntary. And I'm going to show you a slide in a minute that shows the broad level of participation across the state. Primary care providers and clinics are certified, and there's a lot of flexibility that is built into the certification process. We're really looking for clinics to show us how they're taking care of their population. Now, there are five healthcare home standards, and the standards are really built around continuous accessible care that both Dr. Schiff and Dr. Grundy spoke to. But a few key elements around the standards themselves. They really provide a pathway and a set of tools for clinics to become certified and make practice transformation. So you'll see tools like the registry that Dr. Grundy spoke about that allows us to look at a population. The care plan, which is a tool that we see patients on site visits bringing into the clinic and into our team to show them how they use their care plan. And more direct access, which is really important from a 24-hour perspective, as well as that continuous coordination. One of the things that's really positive about our standards in Minnesota is that we're really leading the way across the country, and the new national NCQA standards really are aligning themselves to Minnesota standards so that the rest of the country is going to move forward with us and do transformation in a way that's patient and family-centered, which is really the hallmark of our healthcare home standards. In this next slide, I just really want to point out here that you'll see that this is activity by clinics all over the state. There are 707 or so primary care clinics, and virtually in every corner of our state, clinics are working with us to become certified and to advance their practice transformation. Now let's look at just a few numbers here. First of all, related to the actual numbers of clinics that are certified to date. There are currently today 47 clinics certified, which represents 413 clinicians. Now in this next number related to patients that are participating in certified clinics, we got just a little bit ahead of ourselves, and we included the 47 clinics that we're going to add next week that we're going to be proposing to the commissioners. So as of next week, we're going to be looking at 94 clinics certified across our state with a population of just over 1 million patients that will be participating in a certified healthcare home in the state of Minnesota. We have a number then of clinics that are underway, as you'll see in the detail. But I would just like to point out that in the clinics that have become certified, we have community clinics, we have an FQHC, we have several rural clinics, and we have also some large urban systems. I just want to share with you two stories because I think the healthcare home is about stories and sharing the successes. And the first thing I'd like to say about the actual certification is that we're receiving a lot of positive feedback related to how the certification process guides itself. Guides clinics to achieve practice transformation. One of our community clinics, we usually go out and see a sample of clinics, and one of our community clinics developed their own certification site visits with their team because they thought that the work that the standards and the interview process did with consumers and staff was so important. Another thing I'd like to share with you is I interviewed a patient in southern Minnesota just a few weeks ago on a certification site visit, and he told me that the certification had made and the healthcare home had made such a tremendously big difference in his life. He had three chronic medical diseases and mental illness and had been to the hospital 75 times in the past year. Their organization selected clinics for the healthcare home and offered that services based on the number of times that patients went to the ER. The patient had been participating then in his healthcare home for 6 months, and in the following 6 months, after Barb became his care coordinator, he had one visit to the hospital and to the ER. And he wanted me to make sure that you and anyone I could tell knew that this had made a tremendously big difference in his life. And I have the great opportunity to go around the state and hear those stories just about every day. One of the things that our legislation has required us to do is to put together a learning collaborative. And we know that practices that are making real transformation make an investment related to making that change. And this is one of the investments that the state is making related to implementing the healthcare home. And most successful programs have this kind of transformation. And so we are launching the next phases of our learning collaborative. And just in closing, I guess I would like to just quote Dr. John Helfen. He is the medical director at the Certified Healthcare Home in Staples, Minnesota. And he said to me, he said, Marie, we consider an unplanned admission to the hospital as a failure of our medical home. And there's a new connection around access and a new connection around patient and family centered care. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Ross Owen with the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and I'm here very briefly to talk about the payment reform component of the Healthcare Home Initiative, which is really the resources in the system that are being put on a multi-payer basis into investing in this type of primary care and this vision of transformation that's been described for you today. And in the Healthcare Home Initiative, that happens through a supplemental per member per month care coordination payment that's available to certified healthcare home clinics. And that payment represents all of the work of care coordination that happens really between the face-to-face visits that we as a system have historically not reimbursed for, as Dr. Grundy said. These payments or investments in care coordination are, as you know well, required to be budget neutral, meaning that these dollars are expected to, and in fact required to, show at least equivalent reductions in other healthcare utilization. And the best evidence that we have tells us that that's likely to come from reduced avoidable hospital admissions and emergency department utilization. I won't get into a lot of detail, but I do want to point out a couple of things that are really unique strengths of Minnesota's healthcare home payment system. The first is that the payments are stratified by patient complexity. And this is really to reflect the clinical reality that a relatively small number of patients in a practice tend to take a disproportionate amount of time and resources and effort to engage and coordinate care. And we really want to create the right incentives to engage those high opportunity patients who also are the patients that utilize the most resources in our system. And so what we've done is set up a system by which providers assess the complexity of patients and bill for the services of care coordination on a monthly basis using a statewide administrative standard patient complexity and procedure coding system. The other unique strength I want to refocus on is the foundation of multi-payer participation, meaning that a large segment of Minnesota's healthcare market is moving in alignment to pay for these services in a way that allows the clinics participating to really achieve a critical mass, because this is a model of care that transforms the way care is delivered in a fundamental way for all patients, and that's an investment that can't be borne only by small pockets of the insurance market. And what I want to leave you with today is just a mental image of that challenge of multi-payer alignment and getting to critical mass. What you see here represents the population of our state distributed by primary source of insurance coverage. And the wedges of that pie in green toward the bottom are really the foundation that were required to participate in the payment system through the 2008 health reform legislation. And that orange bar represents the addition of the Medicare fee-for-service beneficiaries who will be joining the initiative in 2011 through our participation in the multi-payer advanced primary care practice demonstration, which is really an exciting opportunity where Medicare has agreed to adapt to local market conditions and join multi-payer initiatives in progress like ours. And so what all of these pieces together represent is really a common agreement across the state about the vision and the model of primary care that we're interested in purchasing, as Dr. Grundy said, and sending that consistent signal. And what Dr. Schiff's going to focus on next is how each of these component pieces, from the certification to the complexity stratified payment to outcomes measurement, really lay an important foundation for future payment reform efforts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you to my team. Just a couple things really quickly. The last component of our medical home, our healthcare home program, is around evaluation. And I think the most important thing we want to say here is that practices will need to produce outcomes according to the triple aim, which is population health, patient experience, and affordability of care, in order to be recertified in our program, which is really one of the unique aspects of Minnesota's program, is that we ask for results to stay in the program. I want to turn our attention now to after healthcare home. People talk next about accountable care organizations, and I want to talk about this because as I was at this committee a little while ago, and people, one of the members of the committee asked what was an accountable care organization, I include for you today two definitions. And the definition I'll read is that an entity that can implement organized processes for improving the quality and controlling the costs of care and be accountable for results. That's a mouthful if you think about how we will implement that as both a both as a provider would implement it and also as a payer of services, which the state is. Healthcare homes are the base for the development of accountable care organizations, and I think that's generally recognized everywhere in Washington as well as here now. Our healthcare home model sets up the move to accountable care organizations for a couple reasons. One is we're looking for robust primary care transformation. It's this is not icing on the cake we're asking for. We're asking for fundamental transformative change. We risk stratify patients as, payments, as Mr. Owen talked about, so that we actually are already having providers think about the graduated standards of taking care of patients of different complexity through ramping up or down the amount of service provided. And as I said, we measure for recertification. The things we need to balance or to start the accountable care organization is we need to understand a few things. We need to balance and place the risk in the right place in the system. Too much risk at a provider organization makes a provider organization a mini insurance broker, and they don't have the capacity, nor should they have the responsibility to do that. And too little risk at that place does not give providers incentive. We need to balance the incentives to providers to ensure appropriate care first, and then to decrease inappropriate utilization second, as I said at the start of my remarks. And we need common methodologies so that providers have a clear message about critical mass so that they can actually change this. And if you can think about an integrated delivery system, on the one hand, getting a lot of money for producing more and more services, on the other hand, being told to integrate and be efficient about what they provide, those kind of mixed messages are really hard for providers to turn on. So we need to get the critical mass. And the last thing I'll say is we need some sort of incremental development, because although we're ready for critical mass, there are parts of the system where we have better or worse risk adjustment, better or worse measurement of outcomes that we need to bring along. Mr. Owen was good enough to put together this shared savings model overview, which I think basically says what we talked about, that we take a standard menu of utilization categories, we look at the baseline costs in the attributed population, we risk adjust that, and we then look at the projected cost, and if there's parts that are saved in the yellow there, we can actually figure out how to split or share those savings between the payer and the provider, in our situation, the state being the payer. There are some components of the accountable care organization that are different than the components of the medical home that my colleague spoke about, and I want to just mention them briefly. In an accountable care organization, we must figure out how to attribute patients to providers, whether we do that passively by figuring out an attribution algorithm based on their past utilization, or that we do it only by patients who are registered, and there are advantages and disadvantages of each. We need to have a risk adjustment that's robust enough that it can be used to predict some amount of total cost of care. And the term total cost of care, I want to point out, is can be misleading, because total costs, some may include long-term care or mental health care, and to others will include only their acute medical care of our patients. We want options for payment, including risk and gain sharing, that are based on the complexity of the patient population, the size of the population, and the degree of integration across the spectrum. Again, looking at the risk an organization can take on. And we also need to be sure we don't move from medical home and fee-for-service payments with the medical home care coordination payment to a capitated model. We need to make sure that the payment is contingent upon outcomes for quality and patient experience, and that those outcomes actually have meaning in order to participate in the accountable care organization. And last, which is especially important for the patients that are served by the Minnesota healthcare programs, we need to make sure that the payment models address the needs of the very complex individuals who are entrusted to our care. So, to close out, just some challenges. One of the most significant things that we're working through right now is the issues around federal authority. federal authority in which and the federal match that we get from the United States government is important because it's important because it helps pay the bill, but it's important because we need to make sure that our patients, both for our own reasons and because of what's dictated by the federal authority, have choice of choice of providers, that they're not limited in choice where that limit's not appropriate, that they have access to services, and that the provider incentives are appropriate, not to deny care. Also, from the point of view of providers, we need to make sure that whatever system we put in place addresses and provides safety from antitrust and anti-kickback provisions. Other challenges I just want to mention are getting to critical volume of patients and, as I said before, adequate measurement of quality. Finally, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I have two other slides just to let you know. One is our websites, which will give you way more information about this. The 2008 and 2010 statutes are available, I'm sure, through your committee administrator. And then the information about accountable care organizations and around about more general information from the Commonwealth Fund. And finally, our contact information. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee.
Well, and thank you for the whistle stop through that. We have a few minutes for questions, and then we're going to hear from, if you look at the list, we have some people who have been working with these healthcare homes. We have four different individuals who are going to give us a couple-minute synopsis of that. But there's Representative Huntley. Do you have a question? I'm taking questions. Representative Huntley, I saw your hand. So.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Dr. Schiff, in your slide that divided up the population of the state by their where they're insured, and you had Medicare Advantage, about 6.6%, if I can see that. Can the state regulate Medicare Advantage plans, or is that strictly federal?
Dr. Schiff?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, that's those are federal.
Okay. And
Representative Huntley?
Then, Mr. Chair and Dr. Schiff, the Advanced Primary Care Initiative that's, I think, you're getting ready to roll out probably in July, we are required to have more than half of the population in whatever geographic area that is under the same kind of plan. So how are you getting the self-insured groups that we can't regulate to participate in that kind of a program?
Dr. Schiff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, that you're absolutely correct about that, and one of the reasons Dr. Grundy's here is to drum up support for that. We have we have actually, through our medical home program, actually need to get a small slice of the privately insured engaged, and we have plans ourselves to start having meetings with the self-insured folks. For the members of the committee who don't know this, self-insured providers are regulated by a law called ERISA, and ERISA is a federal law, and so this body, the Minnesota Legislature, does not have any direct jurisdiction over that. However, with results and with engagement in that community, we have told CMS, and we believe we will get other payers engaged in the same way.
Thank you. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I would suspect good ideas are catchy when they work. I think the other self-insured, such as the IBM example, will definitely be heard and listened to. I think I had also one quick question, though, because supplemental information, we have just a flat piece of paper. It's obviously designed with a hot link embedded into it. We don't have that, so the benefit of your supplemental information only will come if we get an electronic version. If we could just have you do that, that would be good. And then under the private insurance as well, again, does this have an impact on our CGIP, our state employees? Because it's a small slice of the pie, but nonetheless something that if it's good, then we would want to maybe promote it in our state employees as well. Do you know if this is applicable to our CGIP?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, that is applicable to the CGIP population, and I think, is there a separate slice in there for that, or do we, it's represented in the graph. Mm-hmm.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So is it currently being applied to CGIP employees, or is that a future endeavor?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, is currently being applied.
Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair and Dr. Schiff. I have a question about the recertification process of the healthcare homes, and I am wondering how you will go about measuring improvements in population health at that point.
Dr. Schiff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, Marie, do you want to address that?
Sure. Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, our plan is to do outcomes measurement across the population, so the entire certified healthcare home will submit their data related to their population. We are working with a community work group right now to establish benchmarks, and we have just released the first clinical measures, as well as we will have clinics submit patient experience data, and we are using Minnesota Community Measurement, the statewide quality reporting provider, as our vendor.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may just Dr. add Smith, just a little bit to that. We will be using data from the department around cost and utilization for that part of the experience, and it is really the authority of the Commissioner of Health to create the thresholds for recertification, and I'm sure we'll have active conversations with Commissioner Ellinger about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, good. And Dr. Schiff, you mentioned the accountable care organization. The concern was how to avoid capitated models. Isn't it really a capitated model deep down anyway? I mean, how do you make it not that, since that's what it is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, and the same. an accountable care organization, if accountable care organizations, depending on what you read, so for example, in the federal statute around Medicare shared savings, an accountable care organization could be anything from shared savings on top of a fee-for-service model to a fully capitated model. My point that I was making when I said that was this, that if we just have capitation without adequate risk adjustment and adequate adequate look at results as far as population health and patient experience, we risk not taking care of our most vulnerable population, because what we'll do is providers, most will act very much in the faith of their patients, but some will have some incentive to limit care because there's too much emphasis on the financial aspects. You just, so we need to balance that.
Yeah, you've just echoed some of my concerns. So, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I would appreciate that line of questioning. Was a couple questions I had as well. I think the other thing is a practical thing. As far as you and the department handling the time it takes to approve medical homes, how is that progressing? Do you have some numbers? How many have you? How many yet to go? Is there a backlog of medical homes that are waiting to be certified that can't begin using the concept because they're waiting for certification? Just, if you just kind of more broadly just address that in general.
Dr. Schiff or whoever.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kiffmeyer, currently we are right up to date related to certifying healthcare homes. Everyone that has applied and submitted their assessment has the site visit scheduled. We have a number of activities in place in order to help clinics that want to become certified healthcare homes out there in the community around education, capacity building, and the learning collaborative. We attended around 50 site visits over the last several months, and are in the process of having Commissioner Ellinger sign off on the 47 that will become certified in the next couple weeks, as well as we have site visits scheduled, many site visits scheduled. So we're finding that our community site visit evaluation team, we take consumer, we have contractors from clinics that are certified, are very eager and willing to go out and are doing a really great job.
Yeah. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think my other question for you is, with the limited experience that you may have, nonetheless it is, are there hindrances in statute or in rule or in process that, since we're doing our legislative session right now, that you think we could address?
Ms. Mays-Ries or whoever?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, that's a good question and one that we are actively discussing inside the department, so I guess I'll wait for our policy work to bubble up. to answer that. I wanted to, if I may, I just wanted to make one other quick comment about your last comment, and that's that we are in the process of building a system to give feedback to practices on a regular basis about how they're performing, besides just the certification. And our goal with this and with the future Accountable Care Organization statute is to make the Minnesota healthcare system and to support the Minnesota healthcare system being an iterative learning system, so that rather than frozen in time, a certain set of procedures or processes, and then we'll evaluate them. We feel like we need to create this mechanism by which we can always give feedback to our practices so they can always figure out how to improve.
Representative Huntley, you get the last question for this segment.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Schiff, or one of the other ones. People are getting bored with me talking about breaking down silos, but when we move into ACOs, has there been much discussion of how they can coordinate activities with our public health system?
Dr. Schiff.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, our healthcare home program requires coordination of the healthcare homes with community service agencies. There have been active discussions about how to engage the community service organizations. The challenge, I'll be honest with you about it, is around risk adjustment and figuring out what services are involved. And I think we see, as we build an accountable care organization, we see anything from starting with gain sharing to moving to a more integrated approach. And sort of the final approach, as former Commissioner Magnin used to talk about, is accountable health communities. And what I'd really say is we want to get there, but we have to, I think we're incrementally not quite at that step yet.
And Mr. Chair, yeah, Representative Huntley, I'd just like to add that we have begun our journey related to that bridge. Right now, we've currently added 5 public health nurses to our healthcare home team as we reorganize, with the belief that we really need to bridge that chasm between the public health community and the healthcare home as we move towards building community care teams. So our journey has started.
A lot of journeys. Thank you for coming. We have... just one thing offline. You can chat with me. I've been concerned about some of the bar to some of the community health clinics being in this, and you can just give me an update offline about that. So,
okay.
Thanks.
That'd be great.
We now have 4 witnesses, 4 testifiers, who are involved with medical homes, and maybe they all 4 can come down. And we'll take a few minutes to listen to them with their experience. And if you've been noticing, we have lots of material and so little time. Which is kind of like your business of so much work and so little resources. So you'll, if each of you could take 2 or 3 minutes and give us kind of the highlights of your experiences, and maybe we'll have a few minutes for questions. And who would like to go first? Someone just jump in there, introduce yourself, and tell us your story, and we're glad you're here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman Abler and members of the House Health and Finance Committee. My name is Terry Carroll, and I'm the Senior Vice President for Transformation and also the Chief Information Officer at Fairview Health Services. And I'm going to spend more of my time talking about ACO formation, because that is where we're focusing our effort, even though underneath that is all of the issues in and around the medical homes. We are one of the groups that's pending certification of all of our primary care clinics to be medical homes, and we're about ready to get that certification, we hope. But Fairview Health Services is reforming healthcare from within through innovations led by our physicians and staff. We're focused on delivering higher value to our customers. That means that we're aiming to improve quality, improve patient experience, and reduce the total cost of care. Using a process for rapid innovations, Fairview is building the capacity to become an accountable care organization, or an ACO. We believe accountable care requires new delivery, new care delivery, and new payment models. Accountable care is coordinated care across health settings. It is a group of providers working together to manage the health of individuals as well as populations. Accountable care means using innovation to change care to deliver better outcomes. And accountable care requires different and better ways to pay for improved quality and improved care. The ultimate goal of our work is to improve the quality of care and patient outcomes, to improve patient experience, and to reduce the total cost of care. Fairview has worked over the last couple of years to do the following: create the social systems where providers can take accountability for improving care, improving experience, and reducing total cost of care. Define and act upon processes to promote evidence-based practices and patient engagement. To develop the capabilities to manage populations. Identify and develop reporting systems to measure the performance of our efforts. To develop leadership for our networks of providers, which are both independent and employed providers, that will deliver care through the integrated care model spanning the full health system. This means everything from primary care to hospitals to senior services. Our work also is to understand and build the data capabilities necessarily to effectively manage the health of populations, some work that will take a considerable amount of effort and time to create this for the new systems of both care and payment systems. We're developing the clinical administrative systems to support the network of providers, and is taking a focus on being very patient-centered with all that we serve. Several years before ACOs moved into our collective vocabulary, Fairview started a major transformation. Changing that which we can control at the time, Fairview began to work fundamentally to improve care delivery and the patient experience. Since 2008, we have substantially changed our care models. I'd like to tell you about a few.
Mr. Carroll, you're about 4 minutes into your presentation.
Yep, I'll be done.
Just so you know, time goes so quick.
Yep.
Sitting there, doesn't it?
We've designed primary care, which is a lot of the redesigned primary care, into the team-based models, which is what you've heard a lot about in the health home scenarios. We've worked to engage staff in engaging patients in their care. Some of our clinics have piloted a survey aimed at better understanding each patient's level of activation as a result of being able to manage the ability for them to manage their health as part of that process, which is very important. We're working on next innovations of care to deal with complex issues. A lot of these you've heard about through testimony that was done last week on the work that's been developed at Fairview to work with the coordinated care delivery system, where each patient is seen by both a physician and a behavioralist as a routine part of their care. We've created care packages to begin to move across the highest conditions and the highest complexity of conditions to better manage those cares and to coordinate that care process across the entire continuum. We've utilized a full spectrum of providers to help work through that process. For example, in low back pain care packages, we sought input from a variety of providers, including chiropractors all the way through spine surgeons. And we've worked these in other complex cases as well. As also in connection with the work that was done and it was described by Dr. Grundy, we are exploring virtual care as a vehicle and mechanism to better address access and to move that care process forward. And we're investing in new technologies. Ultimately, the technologies will help drive quality and experience. And, for example, we're doing this to create a unified medical record across our whole care continuum. As much as we've made significant changes in the care delivery process, we've also had to work through changes in the care models. The current fee-for-service model does not align incentives to improve quality and control the total cost of care. We've established shared savings contracts in the commercial insurance market, where a material percentage of our revenue is focused on producing values for our patients. So what does this mean? We will get paid on value for the services that we deliver based on the quality of care and our ability to manage total cost of care of the individuals that have been attributed to us. Beyond the commercial market, we need government payers to begin to move in this direction. Aligning the financial incentives is essential to driving change. I also believe it is vital for Minnesota to find a way to move the state programs to a new payment structure that drives quality and reduces costs. The work in our private market has shown significant results both in improving quality and managing the total cost of care down. We believe this approach has the potential to be applied to the public and state programs. Thank you.
Well, thanks. And if you have an idea about how to align those state programs to do what you said, I'm all ears. You got about 2 weeks to figure it out for this cycle, so take your time. But I'm actually only being a little facetious, but we are eager to hear ideas. And the other testifiers, I'm glad you're here. Here's your clinicians. If you could kind of focus on some of the how it's gone and some of the day-to-day part, that'd be. We got kind of overview from the system thing, which I think is very helpful. We got the department, then the system, and now the front. So in any order you like, introduce yourself and give us a few minutes of what a day in your life looks like, or what you learned, or whatever. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Dr. Amy Burt, and I'm a pediatrician from Park Nicollet, and I'm accompanied by Dr. Ingrid Yelkin, a family medicine doc, and Dr. Chris Kopsky, one of the internal medicine docs. And we really wish that we had a lot of time to have our patients here testifying to, because I think the bigger impact that you'll see is actually from the patient's perspective and the community's perspective. Well, I appreciate your letting us talk here today, because what I want you to keep in mind as we give our patient stories is that the value of care coordination to the patients and the value of care coordination to the lower cost of care, and the value of care coordination to be able to provide better care so children and their families can live in the community and have a wonderful life in spite of having a chronic condition. So I'm going to tell you a quick story about a child named Muhammad. It wasn't his real name. It really could have been Johnny or Janice. But in this case, it was Muhammad. And Muhammad was 3 years old when I met him. He had been to the emergency room 15 times for his uncontrolled asthma, and he also had autism. His mom had missed work 27 days in a year. She still had her job, but she had missed work 27 days because of his behavioral health issues and the emergency room visits. Muhammad did not need more medication. Muhammad needed care coordination. We got our care coordinator involved. She accessed community resources, including the Somali community in this case, asthma resources, the educational system, and other resources as well in the community. And now, 3 years later, Muhammad has not ever been to the emergency room in 3 years. He's doing really well in school. Mom hasn't missed work. It's a total success story that was unrelated to my ability to provide medication for him. So that's a great care coordination story for you. Dr. Yelkin?
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this is a story about...
Tell us your name.
I'm sorry, I'm Dr. Ingrid Yelkin from Park Nicollet. This story is about improving patient care and patient experience by using a team approach, care coordination, and alternative means of care delivery beyond the traditional face-to-face visit. My patient is a 49-year-old administrative assistant. She and I struggled to get her diabetes under control because it was difficult for her to leave work to come see me for 15 minutes in a face-to-face visit. After I connected her with our care coordinator, she received regular phone calls to review her blood sugars over the phone and make adjustments as needed to her medications. Her diabetes was more quickly under control due to these frequent contacts, and she did not have to miss work in order to do this. Unfortunately, this past year, she was diagnosed with cancer, which needed major surgery and chemotherapy. Our care coordinator kept in close contact with her during her chemotherapy treatments. She adjusted her medications again without needing her to come in when she was feeling sick from her chemotherapy treatments. On her journey with this illness, she began to struggle with depression. Because her team was so closely connected with her, we were able to provide early intervention for this as well. She has shared with me and our team that she is grateful for the extra attention that she received, ultimately helping her return to work and life more quickly.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Dr. Chris Kopsky. I'm an internal medicine physician also at Park Nicollet, and I'll start with one patient story chosen from my personal banks as a physician practicing in a medical home practice. The story is a patient of mine who comes Friday afternoon. She's in her 90s. Her daughter had to take off work to bring her in for an appointment, and she was there for weakness. This was a vibrant woman who had been living independently in the community. Just over the last few weeks had been having difficulty. We did, the usual evaluations and things that we do when people come in for appointments, but she wasn't sick. but she couldn't go home and live independently and take care of herself. So because I practice in a medical home environment, I was able to call in my care coordinator, who coordinated with the patient's daughter, helping to work with her long-term care insurance, and we were able to get this patient placed in a transitional care unit for acute rehabilitation to get her strengthened and keep her safe, rather than the usual care, which would have been admitting her to the hospital. So the value for this patient was she got the care that she needed right at the time that she needed it. The value for the system is that we were able to avert an unnecessary hospitalization. And the value for the care team is I couldn't have done that by myself. I needed a care coordinator there to be able to help do the right thing for the patient. And, you know, this story is one of many. We all had a very difficult time paring down what we wanted to share with you, because there are so many incidents in our lives that have touched us and made this a better environment and a better way to practice medicine. And as Dr. Bird had said earlier, it's really the patients that can give you even probably more testimony on the meaning of this to them in their lives. And, you know, there's three physicians here testifying from Park Nicollet, because this has been so important and transformational in the way that we practice medicine. So thank you very much for the opportunity and letting us share some of these stories with you, and we'd be happy to share more.
Oh, yeah, I appreciate that. Maybe Dr. Grundy can come down now, and so we have about 10 minutes for questions or comments from members. If people have that, members have questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Oh, yeah. Oh, actually, if you could stay here as well, the other physicians, please stay. You're kind of a panel now. We're sort of getting into this new motif here. It seems to be kind of interesting. So, is there enough? The pages can help you to a chair if there's. John, you got something?
Grab another chair.
Yeah, so please just kind of gather around there, and somebody will ask you a question, and then one or two can answer, and then we'll go to somebody else. Representative Fritz, you get the first one, and then
thank
have
you,
some
Mr.
flowers on deck.
Well, thank you, and thank all of you for coming and sharing this good news. I'm a nurse of over 40 years, and I think it's like turning the Titanic around that we've all tried to do here in the past few years, and it's been a tough one to do that. So I'm very pleased to hear that it's working. And I, Dr. Grundy, your comment about Dr. Welby and the stories that the internal medicine doctor just stated, I remember back 35, 40 years ago as a young nurse in the nursing home when the doctor would bring the patient from home and say that she's here now. She didn't get to the hospital, but he then was like a realtor, sell the house, do this, sell the car, you're here for 20 years. And those are the things that the doctor used to do. We didn't have a social worker or any of those folks back then like we do now. So I've lived quite an interesting life in the medical profession to come to this point where there is a care-coordinated effort in place. And let's keep it that way. And thank you very much for sharing those success stories. And I hope but we still have a lot of work to do and a long way to get there.
Dr. Grundy, maybe you want to tell half the room who Marcus Welby is.
Yeah.
I'm only half kidding. Why don't you tell us that? He was a great.
I think I show my age with that comment, yeah. Don't I? Mr. Chairman and members, representatives, I mean, I think the other thing that we've seen in states, and I was just at testimony with the U.S. Department of Defense last week in Washington, is a 5% increase in primary care retention in the Air Force. In Seattle, Group Health in Seattle, we saw a 15% retention of primary care physicians. I think if you hear a sucking sound, it's the primary care docs going away from states that aren't stepping up to delivering medical home level care, because the young folks coming out into in training want to practice this way, and they don't want to practice without the tools, without the team to do that. I mean, the power of having a nurse and a doctor linked together as a team and coordinating care is so much more powerful than the old solo model of I'm alone, I'm doing this as a cowboy. It's really in a world where our young people are communicating, they're connected with tools and technology. The information technology is going to do to the doctors and nurses' brains what X-ray has done to the vision in the last 50 years. It's a phenomenal journey that they're on. And they're going to have a team to deliver that kind of care. It no longer is a master builder doing a cathedral. it's a plan, and it's accountability for holding to that plan, right? Beginning to look at accountability.
Thank you, and Dr. Gurney. Actually, for the people who still don't know who Dr. Welby was, yes. He was this wonderful, is it Robert Young? Is that who it was?
Yes,
Robert. He was this wonderful elder physician who cared for his community, and he bore children with their families and helped them exit the life. And a time that was so different when people actually lived in a town for a length of time and actually had a job they kept for a career. And anyway, it's a, what's that?
He was fiction.
He was fiction. Yeah. Anyway, Representative Slawick. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember, wasn't there the young doctor that rode the motorcycle, too?
There.
Yeah. Well, no, it's used with Marcus Welby.
Welby was older.
Well, thank you, and thank you for coming today. I just had a question. Who told the story about the Somali boy with autism? Is I sit on the Joint House Senate Autism Task Force, as well as Representative Mack does. And so we're trying to get a handle on autism issues. And we just hear over and over and over about families with young kids that are diagnosed, and the families are just trying to find their way through the system. You know, whether it's OT or speech or play therapy or ABA or where they're supposed to go. And do you see any advances sort of around the autism issue and how we can get a handle? I mean, it would be so great if we had a place, okay, your child has autism, here's where you go. Here's what you do. And it just seems really still very, very fragmented.
Dr. Burt.
Well, I think that that autism is not unique in that for childhood behavioral health issues, that all of those families really struggle. Those are children who have trouble in daycare, so families can't work. They and we know early intervention makes a huge difference in the long-term outcome. But the care coordination piece, for example, for this child, the Somali community actually partners with some of the educational, and there are resources available. As a doctor, that I don't know that, but my care coordinator does. And actually, that mom now is one of our patient partners. So she has helped us learn what resources are available for all behavioral health, whether it's ADHD, depression, anxiety. Some of the kids coming over that have had some trauma in their lives, she's really helped us access the resources for Somali behavior health in Minneapolis in particular. So one of the powers of the medical home is to bring the community in so that you can partner with it. But it's not autism alone that patients struggle with. It's the whole behavioral health piece. And care coordination within the community is certainly a better outcome than care coordination outside of the community. Because people live there, they work there, they want to raise their families there. And the resources are there, they're just difficult to find. But care coordination helps.
Just to say, yeah, that would be, as policymakers, we see this as a big struggle. So the more we could promote it, and we do hear that part of it is depending on the physician and the practice, is a family may not receive any of that. So,
and I can say honestly that without care coordination, it's really difficult. But when you have somebody designated as a care coordinator and the healthcare home mandates that you have patients as partners, together, the care coordinator and patients from the community and the practice as partners, that's powerful.
Thanks. We're almost out of time for this segment, but there's two more questions. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question I have for all of you is how long, I mean, this is some pretty phenomenal results, I would suspect in a rather short period of time. So how long have you been doing healthcare homes, and what percent of your patients are in healthcare homes? And I think you all may have a different answer to that, possibly.
Just one or two of you, that's all we have.
Mr. Chairman and representatives, I mean, if you look broadly at the concept, it goes back to the literature in 1968. It happens to be American literature in pediatrics, so we have a broad experience of this. If you want to look at a population that's driven this, I would say the nation of Denmark, which is much like Minnesota, by the way, is probably further down the road, and they learned how to do this by coming and studying what we did here. It's interesting. They've gone from 157 hospitals down to 21. Phenomenal change in how you look at really handling care and coordinating it, and being positively patient-centered. So ambulatory sensitive conditions, funnily enough, are actually dealt with in an ambulatory environment. You don't treat asthma in hospital. And we've seen the same thing in North Carolina now. We're in our seventh year. We've seen a 44% decline in the number of hospitalizations required for our asthmatic patients in the Medicaid population, right? So we have a broad experience that goes over many years. And here in Minnesota, you have many examples of this going back at least 5 or 6 years. And frankly, you were the first place in the country to really pioneer integrated care, which is the example of the Mayo Clinic. And I would like to see Minnesota be the first example of really pioneering integrated, coordinated, and accessible care, which is the medical home.
Dr. Kopsky, you want to comment?
I was going to comment that we started this with pieces of the healthcare home before we even knew that there was the legislation, and so it's been ramping up since at least 2005 in our adult population. I think that we would formally say we were looking at this to be a medical home in 2007 or 2008. So we were our clinic system. There are certain sites within the Park Nicollet Health System that are certified medical homes, and we were within the first wave. So it'll be since June that we've been a certified medical home for the state of Minnesota.
Great, thank you.
And Representative McDonald has the last question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mack was just curious who Dr. Welby is.
Oh. We'll find you some replays of it.
Probably delivered her.
Yeah. Well, I really want to. I want to. He can't. I want to thank you all for being a part of this discussion. If members would like to do some more, we could arrange a separate time outside of this time for people who want to go into some more detail. I'm sure the different testifiers would be accessible to questions. Thank you very much for your work, and thanks for giving us hope in the system. If the county wants to start coming down for their presentation, members, I want to announce a couple things while they're coming. In your packets, you have a really nice little brochure, Guides to a Health Services Financing Medicaid Primer by John Deal Esquire. So there's the free advertisement. This day is sponsored by John Deal. Representative Kiffmer, I'd like to move the minutes. Anybody want to know about those? All in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thanks for that. Representative Kiffmeyer. And the last thing, a couple announcements. Just make yourselves at home there, the county presentation. There's been some interest in a special trans. Representative Quam would like to be part of that. So the Representative Fritz, Representative McDonald, Representative Quam will be looking into that. And I think there's some legs to get something even looked at besides even a study group. So we'll see how it goes. And just a word about those study groups. I have not managed them very tightly just because I don't have time. But I would like to know where you're at and what you're kind of encountering. And so if the lead person could send me an email just about what they think they're going to get toward, and just so I can, as some kind of a manager. We're all members here, so it's not like I'm your boss or anything, but we are trying to find some ways to work our way around not doing what we'll hear about the first step of, which will be on Tuesday. And so the more we can keep our heads down about that, the better we're going to be. Next week, we're going to be, on Wednesday, we're going to be hearing from the Human Services Department as we fly through their budget. And just to I try to scare my staff, but I would like, if we could, to get through their entire pages that day as they present. We could spend 2 weeks dissecting all those things, and the Department of Health will come the next day. DHS could finish up, have some more time at the end, but we'd like to know where you want to spend your time on those pages. Some are really interesting, and they bring people, and we can talk in detail, and some are like nobody even has a question. They drag staff over for no good reason. So on the frugality of government, if there's something you want to know about on those pages, we'll make sure we have time to emphasize that even as soon as Thursday. Representative Slavik?
Mr. Chair, I just did wondered if there's been any decision if you're going to be carrying the governor's bills. Or
nobody's asked. I would be willing to do it. Actually, I was going to talk to Chair Huntley, Representative Huntley, to see if he wanted the honor of that bill or if he wanted me to carry it. I think it would be, if it defaults to me, I will be the author. But I think that it's appropriate that the lead minority would carry the governor's bill should he so desire. And that would be my view, and no one's talked about it. So I think they only have the book by Tuesday anyway, and then the language will come, and we can take that offline. And there'll be other department bills as well. And I think the coroner has traditionally done that, and I'm sure they'll talk to us. If there's some topic you really want to carry that exemplifies your belief in something, we can chat about that. I am not making any promises. And the last thing, and then Tuesday we're doing House File 8, and we're hearing from the Insurance Exchange, and then some telehealth demo. So you're going to all want to come back and bring your friends for those events. So welcome to the committee, Mr. Scandrett and your friends. We can go in a couple minutes late, so you get the whole half hour, because this is a really important topic as well. And I think if you look at the theme of today, it's really where we are today and cutting edge good ideas. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Michael Scandrett, and I'm the policy counsel to the Minnesota Association of County Health Plans, which is an association of the three county-operated health plans in the state that provide coverage for the state health care programs as well as Medicare in greater Minnesota. And you have a handout packet, and in the packet is a map that shows which counties are in county-based purchasing, and those white ones I'm sure all want to be. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of see where you fit in the map. Just a little context before I turn this over really to those that lead these organizations. And one is just to remind the committee that you have heard a lot about different models for health reform, how to change payment, how to coordinate care. Also heard from the four metro-based GAMC coordinated care delivery systems that worked on the GAMC the new GAMC program last year. So far, though, I don't think you've heard much about how you could make these things work in rural communities. And a lot of the presentations so far have focused on things that might well work in a very highly populated area with many providers, many nonprofit agencies. And also, I think some of the themes that you've talked about and had people present to you up to this point, and in addition to really how to make these things work in rural areas, is how do you coordinate the healthcare programs with social services and public health programs. Representative Huntley, I think, asked a really good question, because this has been a perplexing problem in some parts of the state for a long time, and how do we look beyond the clinics to what's happening in the community and what other services people need that affects their health. And then also, I think you probably all remember, you've had a little discussion about health plan transparency and accountability. And a lot of both points on each side, so there's a little bit of, they're both right. There's a part of it that's right, that there are way too many reports and requirements. There is a big pile of paper that all the health plans, including those that are county-based plans, have to provide. But the flip side of that is all that paper doesn't often provide the kind of information that's most valuable to people that want to understand how the healthcare system works and where the money goes. And as you'll hear from the county-based purchasing plans, as organizations that are accountable to their local communities and connected to their government agencies, they are very transparent in terms of how they both make decisions and where the money goes. So these are kind of the basic themes, and I'm going to first introduce everyone. And behind me is actually our first speaker, Jim Prisbilla, who is with Prime West, and that's 13 counties in western and northern Minnesota. And then on my right is Brett Skiles with Itasca County up north, and Leota Lindwood, who is with South Country Health Alliance, 12 counties in southeastern and northern Minnesota. So I'll let them tell a little bit more about themselves, and then they'll take questions from you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Prisbilla. And just, I forgot one thing, Dr. Golden and your staff, to apologize to you all. You've now come twice and not delivered the presentation, so we're looking forward to not hearing it a third time sometime. So I think probably Thursday would be there. You can tag it onto your budget presentation, perhaps. So that's what we're thinking. So thanks for your... It's nice to see you here anyway, and I think that you all... It's good to have you also hear the county-based purchasing presentation, and I knew you would probably come anyway. So anyway, Mr. Prisbilla, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. As mentioned, my name is Jim Prisabilla. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Prime West Health. We're located in Alexandria and serve approximately 21,000 people enrolled in Minnesota healthcare programs, including PMAP, Minnesota Care, Special Needs Basic Care, Minnesota Senior Health Options, and Minnesota Senior Care Plus. The handout I'll be working from, and I don't have it up for the screen, it's the one that went around. It starts out with what appears after and, correct. That's taken right. If you look at the Minnesota statutes for Minnesota healthcare programs and things related to that, they always say things like HMO and county-based purchasing, health plans and county-based purchasing. We like that because it does clearly distinguish us from the others in terms of what we're all about, even though I think the intent of putting us in those sentences to make us look more like one or the other or to behave like that. But we are quite different creatures in the sense of who we are at county-based purchasing. Many of the things, matter of fact, that you're grappling with and questioning now in managed care were some of the reasons why the original 10 Prime West counties back in the mid-1990s decided to go to county-based purchasing rather than managed care with the private HMOs. Part of that was transparency. Part of that was understanding the flow of the dollar and making sure most of those dollars, if not all, are used within the community to serve who it's intended to be. And most of all, to integrate both the state resource, regional resource, and the local resource to optimize the care and the coordination of care to the individuals living in rural communities. As rural communities, we have scarce resources, so we need to rally and organize as best we can what we have to apply to the individuals. And that is a real founding issue that actually got me to take the job at Prime West 10 years ago. I had worked in an integrated healthcare network in the Rocky Mountain West for several years and was a national consultant, including the American Hospital Association, on network development and integration. So I was attracted to this position because it reached a fundamental thing. It brought payer, provider, and consumer together with a publicly accountable body, in this case the county commissioners, to help decide how healthcare could be delivered, to include local providers, and then reaching out from the rural community out to the specialists as needed. And I'll walk through this real quick, and I won't take too much time going through each slide. But slide number two, or frame number two, talks about the characteristics. These are what set us apart, we think, in many ways, from the other HMOs. I'd like to talk about the transparency issue, and I know you've talked a lot about financial transparency. I'd like to talk about another operational one. We're probably the only entity where you will see our strategic planning retreats publicly posted in the newspaper inviting all to come. I mean, that's about as proprietary as you get. But lo and behold, we are, and that's something we didn't have anybody attend, but they missed a good lasagna lunch.
Did you offer food or anything?
Yes, we did, actually. We were on the shores up in the lake in Bemidji and, you know, one of our counties. Walla, yeah.
Let us know.
Walla. Next time we'll let you know. We'll do that. But then, of course, everything that we do is open. Documents that we do, our financial reports on a monthly basis, our audits are available. Those are things that, and since we are simply Minnesota Care programs, there's really, you see the money coming in. I can tell you, a dollar comes in, 93 cents goes out for health care, 7 cents retained for administration. I can show you by line item where those go then within administration. So those are things that are completely open, and if this committee would like to see that at some time, gladly share that with you. So that's something I think demonstrates we are. In terms of salaries, those are things that we are under the same that the state employee caps are under. I would love to make what certain CEOs make in this state, but I am confined to what I'm doing and devoted to the mission. The community reinvestment of surplus. This is a concept that we've started at Prime West. This is something that I brought when I came. We used to do it back west. We called it, we borrowed it from the banking industry when they're showing, earning their space in the community, doing something back for the community. We saw this resource coming in, the state government resource coming in for an intended purpose for the health care. What we've done is taken that dollar, and when there's a surplus, we kind of plow it back into the soil to see if we can gain even more surplus. So that means gain sharing, that means grants and other activities, including higher reimbursement rates to increase access to such things as dental services. even building and funding two new clinics that serve solely Minnesota healthcare program people for dental services. So those are the things we've used our dollars for over the years. When we have a surplus, we've had 2 years. We had a $6 million deficit, then a $600,000 deficit, and I'll tell you, this past year we had a $9 million surplus. But now we're just catching up to our resource or RBC level of about 340. We're pretty close to our target of 400, and once we reach 400, we'll start burying our profits back into the community. I don't want to go too much more into that. I want to talk about that integration. I was just pleased to hear the previous presenters stress not just what they're doing as a model of how they're doing it, but what they're trying to accomplish. And they talked about triple aim, and I won't go into that. But I know one of the things that is perplexing to bodies like yours and my governing board is measuring performance. Mm-hmm. How do we know we're getting a good bang for our dollar? Well, if you take a look at the triple aim diagram, wouldn't you want statistics and reports that tell you how are we improving the health of the population? What are we doing in terms of the healthcare experience? What are we doing on a, how are we doing in our PMAP population in terms of preventable hospitalizations due to ambulatory care sensitive conditions? Do you see that data? Do you know how much we pay on a PMPM basis for hospital care versus nursing home care versus customized living? Do you see that data? That's where your state dollar is going. And that data is all available. Unfortunately, the way we're submitting reports to the state makes it very difficult to do that. So it's funny, I create one set of reports for my governing board, then create two boxes of reports for the state for something that really does not report what our governing board want to do to operate Prime West. So I've always thought that an irony, but then again, we're subject to the regulations and compliance. Integration is what we're after. Prime West, the county-based purchasing, was all about integration. The challenge, we're specific to rural areas. We are not blessed with a lot of the integrated systems, or some will say cursed, but blessed or cursed in rural areas with a lot of integrated systems. We're largely independently owned businesses, owned and often in spirit as well. We are independent. I'm independent for a reason. I'm an independent person. So sometimes it's difficult to get independents to work together collaboratively. But that's where Prime West has worked as an integrator. And when there's absence of an integrated system, as a Fairview, a Mayo, a Lina, Central Cares, and so forth, the Duluth groups, there needs to be a local integrator. And that's the role Prime West has stepped into in our 13 counties, is to try to do that, to organize the local healthcare system and what we call inside-out network development. Start with the local primary care providers and then look who they need outside the community that can't be delivered locally. We call that virtual integration. In Prime West, we also call that cooperative integration. And when we cooperatively integrate, there's an implicit gain share that goes with that as well. So we work on a lot of those things. The things that we're missing are the exciting things this group, this committee, and the legislature is looking at in terms of how do we get to the total cost of care. So we can put greater responsibility for gain, but also accountability on the provider segment as well, but not to the point where it's onerous. And to a degree, that's where Prime West steps in. When we do these things, we can, as a community, share the risk with our local providers so it doesn't fall on one particular group's shoulder. Prime West is organized, and county-based purchasing is organizationally integrated with public health and social services. You heard in earlier presentations that seems to be a sticking point for healthcare homes and accountable care organizations. When all the popular information regarding ACOs and Triple Aim talk about the importance of engaging public health and social services. I was interested in hearing about the case of the child with autism. That is something we struggle with all the time. And at a local level, and sometimes I think we're blessed in a rural area with fewer players, because it's really sometimes easy to get the caseworker to meet with the teacher, to meet with the school guidance counselor, with the physician or the care coordinator, and work that. And often Prime West will serve as the convener of that, because we are kind of that control of we have that information at our hands. So we are integrated already with the two that sometimes are forgotten, yet very important to cost containment and overall health quality, social services and public health. Then finally, what we're looking at are what are our results. And on the final, I look at the results that Prime West has been able to produce over the last few years. And I posted some of those. I could translate those into dollar signs, and they do. But some of the things that you're looking for in Triple Aim are some of the things I'm reporting from right here. And that's what we always look for, is so many of the things that we provide to the state, some things that are very important to the state and the federal government in terms of reports, are how we are doing with process. We're reporting our processes. We're never reporting really the outcomes of our process. Well, what is your quality management process? What are your outcomes? But more so, what are your outcomes relative to your population? Sometimes we seem to be missing that. But I do understand that higher authority, whether it be CMS in Baltimore or D.C., dictates often what we can do in Minnesota as well. But I think if we can make more effort in trying to get the data that we need to the people who need to see it, that it's outcome-oriented, the better we will be, and the better our dollars will be spent in the long run. And you will certainly take a load of pressure off of the county-based purchasings and the HMOs, as well as providers, when it comes to our administrative burdens based versus what we were charged to do in the first place, and that is improve the care of the population. And with that, thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm going to talk about two specific areas about county-based purchasing, and the first one is...
Well, you have to tell us who you are.
Oh, sorry.
We kind of know, but you have to tell us.
Brett Spiles, CEO of Itasca Medical Care, one little Itasca County up in northern Minnesota. A little history, we started back in 1982, kind of the first managed care organization in the country, we believe, and I make that statement all the time, and nobody's discredited me yet, so I'll keep saying it, about managed care with folks on public programs. So it was great insight with our county leadership back then and with the Department of Human Services to start this program and kind of lead the way for other county-based purchasing organizations. But I wanted to speak particularly about supporting rural healthcare provider networks and what do CBPs do with that extra money, if there is extra money at the end of it, and some of which Jim has already talked about. Just real briefly, I believe one of the paradigms and responsibilities of a county-based purchasing organization is that support of a local provider network, do everything we can to make sure that they have what they need to take care of our members. As Jim mentioned, access to dental, as you all know, is a major headache around the state, but county-based purchasing plans in general have found ways to fix that, provide a solution. It's not rocket science. It's not anything tough. It's just have the dentist come to the board and the table and say, this is what we need. We're willing to accept some of the risk with this, and if you pay us this, we'll certainly see your patients, and they do. I checked with my customer support staff last week, and this last quarter we haven't had one call in IM Care about a person who has had difficulty or trouble to find a dentist. Everybody is getting to see a dentist, which is a great boon for our county. As Jim mentioned, we're all governed by county commissioners, all elected officials. There isn't any secrets about what we do. All of our meetings are public. Anybody can come. The minutes are public. If they want to see our financial statements, they can. If they want to go to the desk at the at local county seat and see what I make, they can see that as well. It's pretty public. They can get any of our employees' salaries or anything like that. Local provider support is one of the mainstays of county-based purchasing. The more interesting piece of my conversation is what do we do? What are we doing with gain sharing, risk sharing, loss years? There are loss years. Are we loss sharing? At IM Care, I think when we hear this near religious fervor about ACOs, we kind of sit back and say, boy, that was a great idea back in the early 80s when we started it, and I believe that we're kind of already transcended some of those laudable goals of an ACO. Where we are with IM Care right now is it's 100% risk adjusted with our providers, and that's not just clinics and hospitals, that's dentists, that's vision providers, that's chiropractors, the whole gambit of regular and ancillary care. They're 100% risk adjusted. Whatever capitation dollar comes into IM Care minus the admin expense goes back out to providers in the community. There isn't any secret about that. The only income IM Care ever shows in a annual statement would be the interest we earn during the year. And since interest rates are low, we don't earn a lot during the year, but that's all right. It's provided a great network, a process for our county. Every year I ask the providers if they want to still be at risk, and with a resounding yes, they do want to be. They enjoy the relationship. They appreciate the flexibility of the plan. They have some flexibility with the payment rates. They sit at a table and say, okay, to fix the dental problem, we know that we're going to have to rob Peter to pay Paul. But we're willing to do that because as a community, that's what this community needs and our members need. So there isn't any secrets about that. And is it working? The latest Minnesota Community Measurement Report shows one of our main clinics at the top of the list for immunization. So I believe that the results are there as well. The other CBPs haven't gone to the same 100% risk extent that we have. but they still, as Jim shared, reinvest all that dollars back into the community. They sit down as that governing board and say, okay, here's our gains, where do we want to reinvest them? It doesn't go anywhere else except publicly, everybody can publicly know where those funds go. I know I didn't take my full 7 minutes, but I know we're out of time, but I just wanted to close that. A lot of our providers have come to me in any aspect and say, without IMCARE, our mom-and-pop shop would close. As a pharmacy, we couldn't make it. As a vision provider, we couldn't make it. As a chiro, we couldn't make it. We appreciate IMCARE being here. As a community, they certainly, any department of Chamber of Commerce will tell you how many times a dollar turns over in a community, and having a local health plan to coordinate these activities is a boon for a county. And with that, I'll turn it over.
Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Leota Lind. I'm the Chief Operations Officer with South Country Health Alliance. We are an 11-county, county-based purchasing plan in southern and north-central Minnesota, with our primary offices being in Owatonna. We started operations in November of 2001 during the middle of the state strike, and has now currently served a little over 24,000 members in the 6 Medicaid programs and also 2 Medicare Advantage programs, special needs plans. I was asked to talk a little bit about the reporting burden. I know there has been a report that's been floating around out there, and one of the things that you've been hearing about is the issue of the increasing administrative burden on not only the HMOs, but also the county-based purchasing plans that is really having an impact on our administrative costs. I think one of the challenges for all of us as county-based plans, as smaller plans and doing only public programs, we don't have that ability to disperse those administrative costs over larger product lines. And whether you're a small plan or a large plan, some of those costs are significant and really does not matter upon the size of the plan. One of our concerns with this is that we are so highly regulated. We're regulated by the Department of Human Services, the Minnesota Department of Health, the Department of Commerce, and also the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And many of these regulations and reporting requirements are extremely duplicative. It's the same type of information that's being asked for by all entities, but in many situations, such as our encounter data reporting regarding our utilization of member visits to physicians, dentists, pharmacy, those types of things, also financial reporting, provider listings and network types of issues, it's all in a different format for each entity. So while it's the same information, you're having to recreate that report multiple times in order to provide that information to the various entities that are requesting it. The oversight activities, again, being governed and regulated by all of those entities, there is also ongoing monitoring through the reports that are submitted and multiple audit processes that all of us are subjected to. With the Center for Medicaid and Medicaid Services, they do a one-third financial audit. So each year, they take one-third of the plans that are contracted with the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services and do a financial audit. Having 2 Medicare Advantage contracts, that means 2 out of 3 years, we're going through a financial audit with CMS. We have the Department of Commerce review every 3 years. We are required to have annual audited financial statements on a yearly basis. Minnesota Department of Health does a triennial audit and then also a mid-cycle review. So we're being seen by them 2 times within 3 years, as well as other types of external audits, surveys and that we are required to participate in. One of the new ones with CMS is a data validation audit, which is a huge scope. While we believe that some of those things are necessary, we don't want to be held to a higher standard than what other situations are. And I think we experience that as a plan, if we have subdelegates that we're asking to do work for, we're held to a standard that we have to do a full audit review of them on an annual basis. These are extremely expensive and extremely resource intensive. And our concern with this is for small plans in economic times where we are stretched and operating at minimal staff, that you're diverting important staff resources away from really focusing on the work of what we intend to do, is provide that quality service to our members to be able to respond to all of the regulatory oversight and reporting activities. While it is also costly, I think the flip side of that is that if our staff resources were being able to be utilized for providing better medical management, more quick care coordination, those really are the activities that you're going to see impacting the overall costs of medical care. As they've already talked about, South Country, too, has had that history of reinvesting the additional dollars back into our local infrastructure, working with counties, supporting county activities, visiting Nurse Hope, nurse programs, partnering with a community hospital, mental health center, the county, and ourselves in an in-reach mental health worker process to reduce ER visits. All of those types of activities, that is that piece too of, as Jim identified, that we've carried out in trying to link that medical services with the community services. For South Country, we have a county connector in each of our member counties that's a nurse or a social worker, and really is that link for us as the plan with those county resources to ensure that we're providing a full continuum of care for our members and getting them looked into, linked into the informal supports that are also available in their communities. I think through this, we've talked about the transparency and accountability. We can submit multiple reports. Many of them are process-oriented, as Jim said, rather than outcome-oriented. And I think really where that additional level of accountability and quality becomes apparent is with being in the local community. Our providers, our local providers, are where our members are being seen. They're interacting on a daily basis with the county commissioners, the elected officials who govern our plan. If there's issues, those county commissioners hear about it, and that strengthens that level of accountability and that commitment to quality that I think county-based plans bring to the table. Thank you.
Well, thanks. We have a few questions, and we're going to go a few minutes past our time, which we're at now. And I don't know what... I'd like some, maybe I'll just give you a list of questions for homework, and then you can, I'm curious about how we pay you compared to how we pay an HMO. And that's a question probably beyond the scope of this now, but we'll get these answers out to people. I'm curious about lessons you've learned about ACOs and about this, that we could export the system. If we're going to take off on a new HCO, you know, system, we'd like to not do some things that why would we repeat past errors? I'm curious about your risk-sharing arrangements, about the dental risk-sharing in particular. I'd like a list of the, if you were us, what reports would you have us turn in? Mm-hmm. I mean, it would. I have you, whatever, you know what I mean. but go through the list. We have a study group on this. Representative McDonald is heading it up with Representative Huntley's on that, and on the health care side, and I know Representative McElfatrick. Are you on that? She's on that, too, and I forget, Grunhagen is on that. And I've asked them to look at these, but it's hard not to give county-based people a white hat. And so you still got it with me, so don't mess it up. don't feel the pressure. So those are things I would like you to give us in the next, 2 weeks or less. Representative Gottwell.
Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, you've covered most of it. I was curious about the work group, but... You know, we've been hearing this over and over again with these presentations about reports that don't really lead us to better care and better outcomes, and maybe don't even lead us to better oversight and cost savings. And I hope our work group or whoever comes forward with some a real good list of stuff that we could stop doing, and maybe a very focused list of what we should be doing as far as reporting so that we can actually get at those things.
Representative Gottwell, probably be a topic of one of your reform hearings if you have time to fit that in. And one thing else I'd like you to, I forgot on my list here, barriers. The only way we're going to get through this whole time is to focus on the 800 or so thousand people we care about. Mm-hmm. And it's all about the clients and patients. How we vend this service is, in my mind, the means to an end. And quality care, which is what seems to drive everybody who is at the table today from numerous plans, is really what we're after, and we can pay for the right amount of services, and there's plenty of money, even in our current budget, to do that, I'm convinced. So if a group of counties wanted to start this up from scratch, and Anoka County doesn't want it, I know that, what barriers are in the way that make this a viable alternative that's even a better one than just some ACO or another whatever, so that generates more visits to my office and people who aren't those. But anyway, Representative Franzen.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just going to say Jim, because I can't pronounce your last name. But but anyway, I want to thank you so much for your tour last Friday at Prime West. And I have to say that I thought we had a very good conversation, and I left very energized after that. And we're also talking jobs here for our counties. And I walked into Prime West, and I knew 3-4 people there, and as we're walking by, I'm like, hey, how's it going? Nice to see you. And he's like, oh, wow, you know another person. But, you know, that's so great to know that people that you see in the community are employed and helping those in the community out as well. And great work environment. I thought people were extremely enthused and loved their job, and that was great. And I believe that local control is the best control. And knowing that your community members and being able to see exactly what health issues they may have, and if they're not being properly treated, to route them to the correct way in order to help them, I just was so impressed that we can do that and help our community get well. And so I applaud the county-based purchasing plans for taking on this venture, and personally I would like to see more county-based purchasing plans. Too bad for Anoka County.
Oh, yeah.
but also, if you could just maybe give us some examples of reports that you find are repetitious, and give us, you know, some concrete ideas, just so that the working groups can also move forward with that. But thank you.
Yeah, and so they'll get those to us. Representative Liebling has the last question, and then we're done.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair, and I'm kind of just, you know, I have trouble not talking about Steadfast when we talk about county-based purchasing.
Bring
because,
it up.
But so, you know, I mean, I just, for the people that weren't here, you know, I had a bill to do this. The counties that are in the corner of your map, these five counties wanted to start a plan, and we're all ready to start it. And we're going to have this plan, which would have competed with the HMOs. And remember, this is only our public program dollars, right? This is what we're only talking about, our tax dollars that go to support our public program patients. And we had it all set. They had the whole thing. So we're talking about what would it take to spread this model. It was going to be spread, and all we needed was a very tiny statutory change that would have allowed them to have by default to get the patients who didn't choose another plan, because when somebody gets on a public program, they get an opportunity to select a plan, and many people don't select, because obviously a lot of people are confused by the process, or for whatever reason they're not able to select a plan. And we wanted those people to just default to the county plan, just so the county plan could get going and have a bigger critical mass of patients, so that they could get their plan off the ground, and got it all the way through, lots of bipartisan support, and was vetoed. So I think there obviously has been and probably will be more interest in this, but I think before counties start this up now, I mean, they are reluctant. They want to know that if they put the initial investment forward to set it up and hire staff and all of that, that they're not going to have that happen to them, because then it was just a waste. But the other thing I wanted to say, Mr. Chair, just really quickly, is our working group, which is mental health and chemical dependency, we're talking about these kinds of models, because there's also a chemical dependency pilot program that's being done in my part of the state. And if along with your list of homework questions, could we add, how are you dealing with mental health and chemical dependency issues under the county-based purchasing?
You bet.
So that would be really great to hear about. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And is Steadfast, they're done, right?
They're done, because they had to disband. They couldn't maintain it, having not been given the go.
Oh, sorry. I think this has been a good discussion. As always, we have more content than we can consume. If members have questions or want contact information for the witnesses, we can get those at this point. We're adjourned. Thanks. Very much.